I want to say first that I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to see so many from this diversified area. This is my first time to meet with the people of the Clinton area. However, I can remember coming through here over 40 years ago in the early 1930s when I first came to the Arkansas Bible School, and they used to bring mostly young folks down to the Bible School on open flatbed milk trucks, truckloads of them. In fact, between here and Choctaw and B Branch, we've got second and third generation people. Some of them are here this morning that, from that time back. But I am glad that at last that I can meet with you folks here in this Clinton area. I'm glad to be here and glad to see so many faces. And as the brother read this morning, this is a day that that God has given us. Let us make the best of it. My subject this morning regards the urgency of the times, I guess we could say. And again, I say, Lord, who hath believed our report? And I refer you again then to the 16th verse of this chapter 12 of the book of John. It says, these things understood not his disciples at the first, but when Jesus was glorified, then remembered they that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. I want you to bear this in mind, keep this in mind, that these disciples, these people that had spent, some of them had spent as much as 3.5 years with Christ, they had done his work. They had heard him review and review and review the things that he was saying. Yet what did they ask at the end, just before his crucifixion? They said, Lord, wilt thou at this time establish thy kingdom? Now, they weren't condemned for asking, we might say, a dumb question. This proved that they thoroughly believed and had been thoroughly convinced that God would reestablish a kingdom upon the earth, but they certainly had a very poor understanding of when it would be. Immediately after his crucifixion, they said, we had believed that this was the Messiah. Now shall we look for another? How strong was their conviction? John, just before he was beheaded, sent two of his disciples to Christ to ask him if he was the true Christ. John baptized Christ. And if we believe the message that is given in the Bible, that immediately God, the angel of God, recognized Christ as being his only begotten Son in whom he was well pleased, John undoubtedly was familiar with that. I don't think it's we're to believe that only Christ was recognized this fact. Yet John, just before he was beheaded, wanted a reaffirmation that Christ was the true Christ. And in the reading, we talk about the miracles that Christ had performed. You know, he was back, went back to see Lazarus up on Bethany, just on top of the Mount of Olives, within a short walking distance of the old city of Jerusalem. For he had performed this great miracle of bringing life back to Lazarus. There was a warrant out to take Christ dead or alive at that time, because the priest, the high priest in Jerusalem, was aware of the fact that if these things should go on, the man's attention, the Jews' attention, would be drawn to Christ and be made believers of him, and they couldn't afford to have this happen. So there was a warrant out for him, dead or alive, and as suggested in the reading before you this morning, they decided maybe they would have to put Lazarus back to death too, because he was a living witness of the fact that this Christ did have this power to do this. So we have them trying to point out to you the two elements, the pro and the con, those for and those against, those that would have you be blinded and be in darkness as opposed to the light. And brothers and sisters, we are living, I don't know, how much time do I have? We are living in a time when miracles as such are being performed before us in a far greater state than bringing one man back to life. We have seen in the past few years, we have seen in the last 50 years, miracles far greater than any miracles that Christ performed. His first performance of turning water into wine, a very simple thing. Chemically, it can be done today by anybody. Insignificant things compared to the miracles that are being performed today. Yet, does the world see? Has the world seen? Or will the world see? Let's look back in history to get our answer. When the children of Israel was brought out of Egypt, God performed a series of miracles that you would think would have persuaded anybody that the God of heaven was completely in control of all things. But how long did that last? They had hardly gotten out of the Egyptian territory and over into the Sinai when they forgot all about it. Here we are on a desert, arid land, and if you ever saw that land, you would know maybe what caused them to think in this term. But where was God? Where was the God that delivered them out of the hands of the Egyptians? Their faith was gone. They didn't believe that God was able to perform those things which he said he would do. They chose, rather, to go with the leadership that would take them back to the leeks and cucumbers in Egypt and be servants of the Egyptians. The miracles that were performed to get them out, to show them that the God of heaven was the only true God and the only God that had the power over mankind and over the earth as a whole, had already faded away from their thoughts. They'd forgotten about it. It just didn't last at all. It doesn't stay. Because of outside influences and circumstances that they see and they can't understand. You know, God says his mind, his ways are so much higher than our ways. We cannot rationalize and come up with facts. We cannot understand the things that goes on. If we try to rationalize it in our own mind and try and figure out how it can be. As soon as you start doing that with God's word, you're lost. There is just nothing that you can do to get yourself straightened out if you have to rationalize and figure out how this could happen. In the 1967 war that Israel fought with the Arab peoples, miracles were performed there such as are still unimaginable, unacceptable. They are not printed, they are not told about, they are not talked about in the world. Because a person who has to rationalize a fact wouldn't believe it at all. It's not even a fairy tale. In 1947 and 1948, when the word that the psalmist wrote in the 83rd Psalm, Psalms 83 and 4, says, they have said, this is the Arabs, this is the enemy, the nations round about Israel. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. Nasser of Egypt said those very words on the Saturday night preceding the war. The very words, verbatim, word for word. Come, let us cut them off. He says, we have a rendezvous in Israel. Some 20 years before that, King Abdullah, the king that had more power, he was the grandfather of the King of Jordan now, had an army equipped by everything that the British had. He advised all the Arabs to move out between there and the Mediterranean Sea, and they would sweep the Jews into the ocean, that there'd be no more. He would wipe them out forever and ever. And then the Arabs could come back in. This is the Palestinian that you read about every day today that left his homeland in order that the Jew be wiped into the ocean, that he be no more. But God says we won't have any of that. There were some 140 million Arabs opposed to about 1.5 million Jews. The odds were that every Jew, every young Jew that a man was able to fight was in jail up at Acre. And all ammunition, all arms of any kind that was capable of even defending a man in himself had been taken away from them because they were all jailed that had ever been found anything on them. And as the British people left the land there in 1947, they turned over all of their equipment, all their modern war materials to the Arabs, including their tanks and their guns, their cannons, their stockades, and all of this stuff was given to the Arabs. They had all the mods. You couldn't put it on graph paper, the odds that the Arabs had against the Jews. And had the war not been stopped by the United Nations, the Jews would have driven the Arabs clear out of the Middle East. Now you talk about turning the water into wine. Some say, well, if I would have been here at the time when Jesus was on the earth, I saw him turn the water into wine, I would have believed, oh, I would have been a real believer. You're a liar, and the truth is not in you if you say that. Because you have seen miracles that can't even be compared to such a simple little miracle as that. And how strong is your faith? How real and strong do you believe? The apostle said, we had believed he was the Messiah. And the apostles of John, when they went to Jesus, said, we had believed that he was the one to save Israel. We had believed, indicating their belief was gone. Because he was to die, he was to be crucified. And he sat there and told them, in this chapter, he says it was time for his death. That part they didn't believe. You see, that wasn't rational, that wasn't reasonable. He came to be their king. How can he die and be their king? And they have to try to understand it in their reasoning. So therefore it isn't true. It can't be. He explained to them, there's a grain of seed, a grain of corn is given in this particular chapter. Well, that grain of corn, if it doesn't die and fall into the ground and come up again, it isn't productive. It's just a plain grain of corn and will deteriorate and be gone. But if it falls into the ground and grows and produces ears of corn with many grains, it was necessary symbolically for him to die. How say ye therefore then, as many of our religious associates say, that Jesus didn't have to die? That Jesus didn't die for himself. How pitiful that a so-called Bible student can honestly say that. How pitiful. It is said that after Jesus' crucifixion, of course, everything went blank. Everything went blah. The hope for a Messiah, dead and destroyed. Now we must look back again. Isaiah wrote a complete history of the birth and life of Christ 650 years before he was born. The Jewish people were very familiar. They had looked forward to that time for the 650 years. They knew very well what was prophesied and what was to happen. As proof is, in the last action, when Christ was crucified, when everything was carried forth, as is revealed here in the 16th verse of chapter 12 this morning, after all of these things had taken place, and they had worked with it, they had helped, they had performed the things that were very things that Isaiah had prophesied and many of the other prophets, they decided at the last, knowing that it was prophesied, and he himself said, referred to his body as the temple that would be torn down, in 3 days he would build it up. All of the things that were said about him having to die and be resurrected, those in authority said, let us be sure that nothing can happen to let these prophecies appear to be true. Let us seal this tomb and let us set a guard around it. Let's be sure he don't come out of there. Can you say they didn't know it? Can it be possible for us to imagine they didn't believe it? I'd say it was pretty well familiar with that fact. Well, we're all familiar with the story that he did come out. It was impossible for the soldiers to keep him in there or to cover up that fact. So what did they do? They poured out piles of money for the soldiers to say that they fell asleep and they came and carried him away while they was not doing their duty. That sounds like the daily newspapers, doesn't it? Payoffs. But the fact remains that they did know, they were familiar, they had been authorized to know for centuries back. Just as we are today. Just as we are today, we have the same opportunities to know and understand. The world as a whole does. But are these miracles registering? Are these things really coming to pass as we should, might say that they should, or that you could imagine if you are one of those who imagines that if you had lived at the time of Christ, if you had been up at Galilee and saw him turn that water into wine, if you had been up at Bethany and saw Lazarus brought to life, if you had seen some of the things that he did and performed in Jerusalem, you would have been no more apt to believe than you are today. The things that are taking place today that have been prophesied even longer. The things that are taking place today were prophesied 3,000 years ago, 35, 3,600 years ago. And hardly a day goes by, or hardly a week goes by, but what something new comes up that brings us closer to our time. See, I heard a man interviewed last week. I didn't quite get it as it started on the KMOX radio interview. There is a man running. He has no opposition yet, but he is running for ruler of the world. I believe his name is Sherman or Sheridan or something like that. I think he originated somewhere in Pennsylvania, but he was being interviewed in the St. Louis radio. And he is running for the position of ruler of the world. Now, it has been suggested by a few individuals, political expectants mostly, that the only hope or the only salvation for the world today is a one government world, a one ruler government throughout the world. You know, this couldn't have been thought about, this couldn't have been dreamed of until our generation. In fact, the world wasn't aware of the rest of the world around. Communications was impossible. But we are living in a time, we are living in the end of times. We are living in the times of the very end. Now, maybe I should explain a little bit about the end of time, or the time of the end, or the times. You can say, well, when was the time of Christ? Well, we have a record of the time from the time he was born till the time he was crucified. It was around 34, 35 years. I'm not exactly sure when. Well, all of that period had to be the time of Christ, possibly a little bit after that time, the things that went on, was the time of Christ. The time of Moses, a time, no time is limited to a 24-hour period. And we are living in the last, not the latter days, but we are living in the last days. The things that are happening today are things that could never have happened before. It could not have been understood that men would, for the fear of the things coming upon them, would pray for the mountains to fall upon them. For fear of the things coming upon them, would pray for the mountains to fall upon them. It could not have been possible for many of the things that have come true today that could have been understood in times past, in the very latter days. The very fact that Israel is being regathered, this was a prophecy that was to be brought about into the new kingdom. The very fact that there is an Israel to be regathered is a miracle in itself. There is no other nation, there is no other identity, no other group of people much newer, much younger than the nation of Israel that is still identified as the same people that they were at the time of their origin. Yet we have the Jewish people, or the same Jewish people with the same place, same belief, the same unbelieving people, I might say, at the same time. And let me tell you that I know that the Jewish people are not that great, they are not that godly people. It is so plainly written, plainly exemplified in the book of Ezekiel. Let's turn to the 36th chapter of Ezekiel. And in the 22nd verse, in the 3rd and the 4th I shall read, he says, "Therefore say unto the house of Israel," this is speaking to Ezekiel, "thus saith the Lord God, I do not this for your sakes, O house of Israel, but for mine holy name's sake." Why is this being done? Why did God create man? "For his own pleasure," he said, not for the pleasure of man. God created man for his own pleasure, and he says in spite of man he is going to wind up with man that will give him pleasure. He chose a people, they rejected him, and he destroyed them. He destroyed many of them, and he has punished the rest of them for 2,000 years. But he says his word will not come back to him void, therefore he must make it a success. And he's saying right here, and speaking of the regathering, he says, "For mine holy name's sake, which ye have profaned among the heathen, whither ye went." He's condemning them for whatever they did and wherever they went. "And I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the heathen, which ye have profaned in the midst of them. And the heathen shall know that I am the Lord, saith the Lord God, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes. For I will take you from among the heathen and gather you out of all countries and bring you into your own land." And brothers and sisters, I submit that there isn't one single indication anywhere in your Bible that says he shall ever take them out of their land again, or that they shall ever be driven out of that land again. Not one single place in the Bible that would indicate that. They're not all there, but they're coming in there. Now, how long is it going to take? Only the God of heaven knows. But the things are shaping up. The action, the last days, the last thing that was to be done. The drying up of the Euphrates River, making it possible for this to come to pass. The last vials have been poured out, the last of the predictions. Prophecy is filled up almost to the end. And God is performing great miracles today. We are reading constantly of the things that's taking place in the United Nations, the things that are taking place over in, say, Lebanon today, and in Israel, the threats that are poured out upon them. The Israeli people are living in a hardship under conditions that you cannot realize. You can't possibly understand. Their faith isn't, well, I want to say as it should be, it isn't good enough. They know, they are all aware that someday God has promised that they will be taken back into that land and that they will be preserved. They know that. But what they don't know is when. So they're in just as much danger as if the promise wasn't made at all. They're living a living death day after day, knowing that not only over the 100 million Arabs that are around the bottom and supplied by all of the military nations of the world to destroy them, but Russia itself, that they know sooner or later will have to take action against them. And what chance do they have? What are their odds? Now, they don't know what any hour, any day may bring. They are suffering death daily. God is punishing them. But he is telling them straight out again, as I've read in one case here and a number of references, where in spite of what they are and who they are, he is going to make a nation out of them. And he is doing it. It is taking place before your very eyes. And as the odds get greater and greater against Israel, as nation after nation turn against Israel, and they are doing it, everyone will. Israel will stand alone. They have practically nobody right now that they can really depend on. The United States is still more or less assuring them of their protection, but knowing the record of the United States in the last 10 years, this doesn't mean a whole lot. So even that assurance given to them doesn't really guarantee them anything. It is nothing concrete for them to stand on. But as these things develop, brothers and sisters, the message I would like to bring to you is to correlate them with the scriptures, with what God has said, with what he has had the prophets write to us, with what Christ said while he was on the earth before, that he would return again, and he is going to return to his people. There is no question, should be no question in our mind at all, that when the odds get really great, if you look at the things that have happened in your lifetime as being miracles, as the old slogan was in one of our presidential elections about 15, 16 years ago, you haven't seen anything yet, would be the most applicable phrase I think that I can think of to describe what will take place. Because behold, the Lord was there. And he says his word will not come back to him void, but he will glorify himself in the presence of the heathens round about. And how is he going to do that? How did he do it? Again, let's go back in history to the time of Joshua. What happened in the land of Canaan in the time of Joshua? There was no problem. As I remember old brother George McPhee, one time down at the Arkansas Bible School way back over 20 years ago, made reference to this, and he made this comment. I hadn't thought of it up to that time. When the armies of Joshua went against the armies of the kings of the Canaanites, he says, not a soldier was lost. And we have no accounting of a soldier being lost. They wiped out their enemy one by one, destroying them completely. This in itself is a miracle for not a soldier to be lost. They did these things to a point where a couple of the kings in the land came to Joshua and made a deal, and Joshua went against the will of God and was punished for it, but he made a deal to save them, to go around them, to not come to war with them. This wasn't good enough. God then chose to take smaller numbers, not take the armies of Israel. You know, when they went across the land, two of the tribes wanted to stay across the Jordan. But the condition was that the fighting men, the soldiers, they all go into Israel's way. We assumed that not a man was lost. Then we got it down to where the army was cut down to as much as 400 men. You know how they were chosen? By the way they drank their water. They took 400 men and did the same thing. To show the power of God. To prove to the heathen round about that the God of the Israelites was the true God, was an all-powerful God. Brothers and sisters and friends here today, the same thing is going to happen again. As the friends of Israel are eliminated, destroyed to the degree that God sees fit. Not all, because it is revealed that those that are left, the Scripture says, will be made to realize, will know. Do we follow this thinking? Do we think in these terms? Are we aware of the things that God is performing on the earth today? Or should we? Our entire faith, our security, our hope is tied up in understanding the times, in understanding God and His Word. Jesus said, "My words are truth and they are light." But what did He tell the Jews when they asked Him foolish questions, when they tried to trap Him, when they did different things to Him to show their disbelief in Him? He said, "If you had have known my Father, then would you have known me?" Why didn't they accept Christ? Why didn't they believe Him? Because they didn't know God. Now what do I mean when I say they didn't know God? Oh yes, the Jews believe in the one God of heaven. They believe in their Yahweh. They did then, they always have, and they do today. Very, very strongly, they believe in one God. The Arabs do too. They believe in the same God of Abraham, only they call Him Allah. But do they know God? No. They do not know God. Christ told him so I can feel safe in saying so, that they yet do not know God. To know Him is to know what He says, know what He teaches, know what He breathes, know how He acts. You hear those say, "Well, if there was really a God in heaven, an almighty God, would He allow a city to be destroyed? Would He have allowed 6 million Jews to be cremated? Would He have done that if there was a God?" When a person says that, they only display their ignorance of God. They don't know God at all. They don't know about God. God has spent His entire time with His dealings with humanity proving exactly the opposite. First place, Adam was thrown out of the Garden of Eden simply for eating an apple. He was taken down from the state of very good to a mortal being. He allowed one of Adam's sons to rise up and kill the other. And you say, would God allow a city to be destroyed if there was a God? What happened at the time of Noah? Everybody was destroyed from the face of the earth, man and animals, except Noah and his wife and Noah and his three sons and their wives. Now, would God do a thing like that? If you know God, you wouldn't question this at all. There could be no question in your mind. If you know God, if you really know the God that you pretend to know, that you say you know, then you have to know the history of Him. You have to know what He has done and what He says He'll do and what He says He has done. This is what knowing God means. Not just saying, "Oh yes, I believe in a God. I believe in God." A lot of people do that. But it's an empty statement. It doesn't mean anything. You see a man out here and you say, "I know him." Well, maybe you heard of him. Maybe you could call his name, but you know anything about him? Do you know what he would do under certain circumstances? Do you know how he would react to certain situations? That's what it means to know a person. Not just to be familiar with his name or his face or his telephone number. And Jesus said to the Jews, He said, "If you had have known your God, then would you have known me?" Well, I guess if he would have lived long enough for the circumstances to be turned around in such a way, he would have said the same thing to his apostles. If you would have known me, you wouldn't have been surprised to know that I had to die. If you would have really paid attention, if you would have really listened to all the things that I had said, and all the ways that I had presented myself, then you wouldn't have been thrown for a loop when I was crucified. That's what he's saying. Now, when the water was up to the neck of the people of the world at the time of the flood, I suppose there were some of them then believed and realized that no one knew what he was talking about. But it was too late. It was too late to think about it then. And the world is going to be in exactly the same shape in a very short time when God presents himself again, when he presents himself, his Son, on the earth again. We're already told exactly what's going to happen. Just as Isaiah said what would happen when he came the first time, we know exactly what's going to happen the second time when he comes. How is he going to be identified? As the Antichrist. And what is going to be the result? The Christian world will march against him to destroy him, identifying him as the Antichrist. That's why I can't be called a Christian without a lengthy explanation. Because the Christian is the very person that is going to march against the Son of God to destroy him, to put him down, and identify him as the Antichrist. And the Christian world will back him up, go right along with the whole thing, back up the movement, not Christ, with the whole thing, and some few that are left will be able to say the same words that the apostles said after Christ was crucified and resurrected. These things understood not his disciples at the first, but when Jesus was glorified, then remembered they that these things were written of him, and that they had done these things unto him. It's a little late in the season to start recognizing the things that are taking place. Sometimes it's too late to make preparations to do the things that you know you should have done. These things are taking place today, this very morning, this very day. And our faith has to be strong enough to take it as it comes, regardless of what happens. God's will be done. There isn't a power on the face of the earth that's strong enough to prevent it. And the greater the odds get, the closer our redemption is to us. I would ask you this question this morning just as a case in point. If there was an announcement came from Jerusalem that God's kingdom was set up, the Son of David had established a kingdom in Jerusalem and demanded the allegiance of all of the world to come and pay tithes to the King of the Jews, what do you think would happen? You can answer yourself. What do you think would happen if this declaration went forth? Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Crusades, the so-called Christian wars that took place back in the 11th and 12th centuries, when wave after wave after wave of soldiers were sent across Europe to destroy the Jew, the God killer, the Christ killer. That considering that was you haven't seen anything yet compared to the great Christian advances that will head towards Israel when the King of the Jews establishes himself in the mountains of Israel. And unless you're very careful, you'll be found in this waves of opposition to the Son of God. Because the world, the Christian world as a whole, will be involved. They will be united. Because their slogan will be, united we stand and divided we fall. They will be drawn together. God has already revealed this to us. That the time is coming when all the Christian churches will be united together under one head. And that head will be Rome. That old harlot. And they will lead this movement. They will be the one that will identify the Son of God as the Antichrist. And all the Christian churches will be joined together. Now this today is a hard saying. I've been saying it for 35 years. And I said it to the son of a Baptist minister one time when I was in college. And he stopped flat on the street, was walking home from the library in the school one night. He turned right around, looked me straight in the face. He says, "Do you say that wherever you go?" This was a shocking thing to him. He didn't think anybody would say it in public. I lost an awful good customer in St. Louis a few years ago, a woman that belonged to the Church of England. And she says, "Well, our church would never join up with the Catholic Church, would never join with the solidarity of the Christian world." I looked her right straight in the eye and I says, "Your church will be among the first." And it is practically there now. I never did get very far away. Well, I lost that customer. She finally paid me a year later for what I had done. She never called on me doing more work. That's all right. I don't mind at all. But this is the way it's going to be. I mean, God has said so. He has made it a united thing. The Christian world will reunite. They will be gathered together for a short period. But they will be united against it. But we're also told that the heathen, when Christ establishes his kingdom in Jerusalem and sets up the kingdom of the world, that the heathen shall not set their foot on the land again. Now, I have a number of references here that I would like to read. This could go on all day, you know, but time doesn't permit. But as of now, the heathen has occupied even the holy temple grounds in the city of Jerusalem, and this last actual episode of war and rumors of war and carryings on in Jerusalem is caused because a Jew proceeded to go in and pray on the temple grounds. The holy grounds where the Temple of Solomon stood. Now the Arabs have two temples on that ground, and they pray and they take on there all the time. They moan and go on. I stood there and watched them go through their motions. But for a Jew to go on that ground and offer a prayer to their God has created disturbance around the world. Even had a couple of special sessions in the United Nations because of it. And the scripture speaks time after time after time of this condition, and that this condition is going to change. It hasn't changed yet. There's a lot of things involved in the occupation of the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, the Holy Land, and so on, that have not been fulfilled yet. But it is in the process of being fulfilled. How long it's going to take, we don't know. But we do know what's going to happen. Just as they did at the time of Noah, just as they did at the time of Moses, just as they did at the time of Christ. They're all familiar because their actions indicate that they did exactly what that thing to counter what the prophets had written years and years ago. They are doing it today. I have a file full of magazine articles. You don't get this stuff in the newspaper, but magazine articles trying to tell how come that Israel won the battle, the different wars, the different battles that they have battled with the Arabs in the last 27 years. Never one has ever suggested that God had anything to do with it. They always come out to some wild, fantastic story. They want just the way the cookie crumbles this time, but the next time they'll get it. Just like they did back in 1973. This was supposed to be a proof that the Arabs could fight and defend themselves. It's still referred to by the world as a war that proved that the Arabs could defend themselves against Israel. The Arabs were defeated worse in 1973 than ever before, because the Jews didn't start war for two weeks after the others did. They let them go as far as they could, as far as they knew how to go. Like they said, the Russians told them how to cross the Suez Canal, but they didn't tell them what to do after they crossed it. So they let them all get across, all their equipment and all their soldiers across the canal, and they moved in and took it overnight. So whether it was within seeing distance, walking distance, I had a friend of mine that was on the Egyptian soil and saw the twinkling of the lights of Cairo, because he was in the front lines of the Jewish army. And the armies was cut off behind the lines, across the canal, and had to beg for water. And if you remember that short time, the newspapers was full of it for a couple of weeks. The United Nations had to come in and demand almost that Israel allow the Egyptian soldiers to have water to drink. Now, and it was presented, is that proof that the Arab soldier is capable of defending himself against Israel? Think about it. And also think about the headline statements that you read in reference to it, the propaganda that's poured out. Be careful that you closely analyze the things that are being said today, because we have a terrific, potent denial of the God of Israel. This is the whole purpose of the world today, is to deny that there is a God, much less the God of Israel. The God is dead theory, and the atheistic movement is growing by leaps and bounds. This we have to be careful of, especially with our young children. Because it is a duty of ours, a command of ours, to bring up our children to know God in the way that they should go. And we are living in a time and facing a time when it's going to be very difficult to teach a young child of God and have him believe the things that are true of God in light of that which he must encounter in the world today. It's a terrible obligation. It's an almost an impossible task, but it's one that you're commanded to do. We are going to have to fight harder and harder daily to maintain our own faith. And in light of what I've read to you and said this morning, we'll have to realize that many of us will fail. We won't be able to withstand the things that we must face. And we can look back after it's all over, and hopefully some of us can say that we look forward to the terrible disaster that is coming upon this world, knowing that the faster the world comes to such a climatic, disastrous end, the sooner our redemption will be. So we should not look upon the things that's coming upon us as the world does, that they pray for the mountains to fall upon them, but they pray for the time soon come when the Master will make his appearance, and his defense will be our defense, and we will not have anything to worry about. If we're serving him, he is able. God is able to save us out of anything, as he saved Daniel out of the lion's den. Our God is able to save us under any and all circumstances if we put our trust in him. But let us not lose our faith. Let us not say when things begin to look dark, we had believed that God was able to save us, but now should we look for another? I think our time is up, and I shall close, and I thank you.